You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. This week on Open Source RVA, we'll talk about the state of regional cooperation with Bob Crum and Wendy Bertner-Owens of the Capital Region Collaborative. And we'll shine a little light on Richmond's windowless apartments with David Johannes of the Richmond Planning Commission and Style Weekly's Scott Bass. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. In concert with his two-day conference on energy, Governor Bob McDonnell announced plans to switch state vehicles to alternative fuels. In this case, alternative fuels specifically refers to propane and natural gas, the respective domains of Blossman Gas and Clean Energy Fuels Corporation. These companies secured state contracts to provide these fuels, as well as the appropriate infrastructure. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports McDonnell as expressing his delight at saying, "We are the first in the nation to take this step in converting our fleet to natural gas, though states across the country have done variations on this theme, some even making use of hybrid and electric vehicles. This push corresponds with General Assembly legislation and an executive order from 2011 requiring the state to proceed with Virginia's 2002 Public-Private Education Facilities and Infrastructure Act. And the Federal Energy Policy Act of 1992 did establish standards and long-term goals for domestic and alternative fuel use for state fleets. McDonnell emphasized the importance of his measures in reducing dependence on foreign oil and expanding the domestic market. Richmond saw 11 homicides this September, the most per month the city has experienced since 12 homicides were reported in January of 2006. Mayor Dwight Jones issued a media briefing on the topic this week. He praised the quick response and turnaround of the Richmond Police Department, noting that the city's rate of charges laid is higher than the national average. The public got props from Jones as well for more cooperation with the police. There does not seem to be a common thread to the killings in terms of organized gang or drug activity, but the briefing does note that 9 of the 11 homicides happened in the first precinct, which is from the east end of the city along the James River into the south side. Mayor Jones plans to amp up police presence in the area. The briefing ends mentioning that Richmond's efforts in many areas, particularly work to reduce and deconcentrate poverty, is significant in driving down overall crime. The 6th annual Richmond Zine Fest is slated for Saturday at the Gay Community Center of Richmond. The event brings together dozens of local and national zine creators who will sell and exhibit homemade publications that feature music and the arts, comics, politics, and subjects chronicling their lifestyles. The gathering, which starts at 11 a.m., will also feature how to publish workshops on everything from journaling to fiction writing, as well as tips from experienced zine creators on networking and distribution. The Richmond Zine Fest is free and open to the public. For more information, log on to richmondzinefest.org. What's the latest buzz in Richmond? The Beehive Design Collective's True Cost of Coal Show. Renowned for their large format pen and ink posters, the Beehive Collective is an all-volunteer art activist collective. Over 3 years in the making, the True Cost of Coal is a collaboratively made, highly detailed allegorical illustration depicting the complicated history of mountaintop removal coal mining. It will be brought to life by storytellers and educators who explore the connections between our local everyday stories and the bigger picture. The Bees will be presenting tonight, 7 p.m. at the Bainbridge Collective, which is at 1300 Bainbridge Street, and the show is free.
The Beehive Design Collective, known internationally for their awareness-raising graphics campaigns, is coming to Richmond with The True Cost of Coal, Mountaintop Removal, and the Fight for Our Future. In this interactive multimedia presentation, the Bees will take you on a tour of the connection between mountaintop removal, climate change, and the struggle for social justice in Appalachia. This free presentation begins at 7 p.m. on Friday, October the 5th, at the Bainbridge Collective, 1300 Bainbridge Street, and it's open to
everyone.
You can learn more at beehivecollective.org. The bees will be followed by live hip hop featuring Richmond Legends Sword Play and P.T. Burnham. Thank you.
One, two, three, four. Can I have a little more? Five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. I love you. A, B, C, D. Can I bring my friend to tea? E, F, G, H, I, J. I love you. Sail the ship. Chop the tree. Skip the rope. Look at me.
The Richmond region is like one big family, a family that's been on a very long car ride in a cramped station wagon. The city of Richmond, Henrico, Chesterfield, and Hanover counties in many ways have very little reason to cooperate other than that we're all on this trip together. Because of Virginia's system for setting up local governments, it can sometimes be tough to get everyone playing together. Enter the Capital Region Collaborative, a concept hatched by the Richmond Regional Planning District Commission and the Greater Richmond Chamber of Commerce. Less an entity than an activity, the concept is essentially a community exercise in team building that began a few years ago at the grassroots level, literally soliciting the ideas of thousands of average Metro Richmonders of all walks of life. Their ideas have since been compiled in a draft report that now is slated to be taken up by community leaders with the hopes that by forcing them to work together on solutions, it makes it more likely that those solutions become our reality. I'm here with Bob Crum, Executive Director of the Richmond Regional Planning District Commission, and Wendy Bertner-Owens, Project Manager with the Capital Region Collaborative. Thank you guys for joining me today. And we're here to talk a little bit about the, I guess we'll call it, you said an interim report on what the collaborative is up to.
Report from the community. That's kind of what we're calling it.
This is our report to you.
Yes, exactly. It's the community's report to the Capital Region Collaborative Council, I guess, is one way to look at it. Yeah.
Can you, one of the two of you, tell me a little bit about where the idea for the collaborative first came from?
Sure. So the idea for the collaborative came about in 2008. And the notion was, what if government leaders and business leaders in the greater Richmond region could come together and through a collaborative effort, working with one another, drive progress and change in the Richmond region? The idea being that we have a region and a community with unbelievable potential, and could it be possible through collaboration to take the region and raise it as a metropolitan region to strengthen our economy, strengthen our quality of life? I'm fairly new to Richmond. I arrived here in the fall of 2008.
And now, some of this was already ongoing when you got here, or?
Well, the notion of a collaborative was talked about, but it was not started. And when I arrived in the fall of 2008, Kim Schiller, who's the CEO of the Greater Richmond Chamber of Commerce, he beat me to town by 3 weeks.
Also just arriving. And by the way, I guess Kim is the person who's not in the room today, but he is what is his title? I guess he's the chairman?
He would be the CEO of the Greater Richmond Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
So Kim and I got together and sort of plotted this strategy for how we could advance the Capital Region Collaborative. We formed an organizing council consisting of about half business leaders and half government leaders.
And it's a list of who's who. It's basically who is in the collaborative report now, correct?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. that's correct. Right. And they had their first meeting in January 2009. And the first thing that we talked about was the idea of a collaborative is not something new to Richmond. You've probably seen the number of previous efforts, and we recognize
that. I'm pretty sure that there's a room at City Hall reserved for all the various reports.
Well, exactly. But that's a great lead-in, because the difference in this is that we really were committed to not having this be a top-down effort. We were really interested in community building and community ideas coming up through the population that could help drive this effort. So the first thing the organizing council, the business and government leaders did, was ask Kim and I to go out and ask the community, what are the important priorities in the Richmond region?
And some of our listeners may be familiar with these meetings that occurred throughout the community, not just in Richmond City, but all over, and with a variety of social groups, I guess. You were trying to be very inclusive.
Yeah, absolutely. We did 85 public meetings, everyone from nonprofits to neighborhood associations to the Rotary Clubs to major business leaders in the community. We did two meetings through the Daily Planet with the homeless populations. We tried to be as inclusive as possible. In addition to that, we did a scientifically based telephone survey as well. And all told, we had over 8,000 residents participated and gave us input into what the priorities should be for the region.
I went to two of the collaborative meetings, and they were really well attended.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get the majority of your responses? Was it from the telephone, or was it from people actually taking the initiative and coming to these?
Most of them coming to the meetings. We had 1,600 people in the telephone survey. The balance were people that took the time to come to the meetings, whether it be the public forum at the Richmond Times-Dispatch, or whether it be honestly, the best input we received is when we went out to the Rotary Clubs and the neighborhood associations and those groups. And
what was it like? The homeless population, you said you went to the Daily Planet twice and tried to get some feedback from that population. What sort of feedback did you get?
It was a really good experience for Kim and I to go through, because it really just redefines what priorities are. So, for instance, if you sit in one area in a certain position in the region, you might be talking about things like a ballpark or like a coliseum or other things. But when you go and reach out to the meetings at the Daily Planet and people talk to you about the need for transportation to get from where they want to work to where they need to get for their meal. And when a single mother stands up and talks about the need to get her children to daycare, be able to get to the job, and then to be able to get to the shelter so they have a safe place to sleep tonight, it's a whole different lens to look at the community through, and that was very valuable for us.
So what you came up with at the end of this process is you sort of broke it down into categories.
Mm-hmm.
The one I'm surprised not to see on there as an individual category is K-12 education, but that's just me.
Right.
but you have social stability, workforce preparation under which K-12
Correct.
Falls,
mm-hmm.
job creation, quality place, James River, healthy community, and coordinated transportation. And what's interesting to me during the process of all this thing of this was that there were, it wasn't other initiatives, but there was sort of it seemed like a time of renaissance, I guess, in terms of community engagement.
Right.
You had the collaborative thing going on, and then you had the city was looking at that time at Rachel Flynn was still here.
Right.
And Rachel was in the middle of looking at the riverfront and the big plan for the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was just a lot of civic engagement, it seemed like. Can you talk a little bit about how those categories sort of shaped up as you were going through the information that you compiled?
Yeah, well, two things. First of all, yes, there was a lot of civic engagement. There still is a lot. And that's one thing that we found in not just through the community engagement, but in diving deeper in some of these categories and preparing to write this report, is that there's a lot going on in Richmond. And the community said this in almost every priority. There's a lot going on. There are a lot of people that are very concerned about X problem or this, but they're not necessarily coordinated. So one of the things that I think they identified before I came on board even was the need for this collaborative, for this process, is one of the needs is to get everybody kind of swimming in the same direction, so to speak.
You pretty succinctly say that in the report, or I guess in your online literature as well, where it's basically the collaborative it grew out of a genuine need, or at least a public perception, that there's, as I guess you guys put it, there's a lot of talk and no action between the localities.
And we heard that a lot. Bob and Kim heard that a lot when they went out to talk. And I think that core to our purpose and the collaborative's being is collaborating. We are not a collaborative of service providers of this or that. We are here to promote collaboration. We're not here to take over for anybody. We're not here to say you're doing your job wrong or you two nonprofit organizations need to merge to do it better. But we're here to promote collaboration. And you know, right now we broke these into the seven priorities that you just listed. But what we know is some of the issues cross. So the K through 12, for one thing, it does fall under workforce preparation in this particular document. But we also recognize that that's part of job creation. That's part of community building or social stability, that, you know, our educational places are community places as well. So there are going to be some very specific things that run throughout all of the priorities. But being human beings, we needed to have some sort of organization process to it.
So now, again, this is our report to our leaders at this point. The next step in this is actually, I guess, the collaborative leadership now is going to look at it and try to distill it in some way, or what is next?
No, not exactly. What we're doing next is a mid-step, and that is we're creating work groups, one for each of the priority areas. Those work groups are going to be led by a facilitator and a chair that is at least a chair, sometimes co-chairs, that are subject matter experts, community leaders, and then the work groups will be populated with about 25 people that are subject matter experts and just citizens, community engaged citizens. They're going to look at this and they're going to say, okay, this is what the community said in this particular priority. Kind of do some fact checking. Do we have a perception problem, or does this particular point, is this kind of real? How do we know it's real? What's the evidence to show us that this is real? And then make some recommendations to that council that we talked about for not just how do we move the needle on some of these areas, but how do we measure in the future? What kind of indicators do we want to, what kind of evidence do we need to look at to say we're doing a better job here? And we're also going to cross, again, just to say that the chairs and the facilitators for each of these groups will meet to talk about issues that cross across all the priorities.
Now, is there a final step in this process? I mean, one thing that in researching this before you guys came in today, I was talking with a local political scientist about sort of what the collaborative is and what it does, and I'm still working on whether or not it's a noun or a verb. but he was saying that really in a lot of ways this is not a last ditch, but this is an important effort to foster some real regional collaboration, and we don't have all that many really good chances to do it right now. We have sort of this inertia, or not inertia, the wrong word there. We've got this activity going on where there's an interest in it. How important is seeing this thing through and getting some?
I think we're sitting on the verge of a tremendous opportunity here. And setting the collaborative aside a second, there's just so many things happening in the Richmond region. River City, the bike race coming, the Amazon facility opening up in Chesterfield County, our port reemerging as an economic development driver. You know, you can go on and on and on. And we just think that with the economic downturn that we've seen, that there's going to be some metropolitan regions that are going to come out of it as winners, and there's going to be some that aren't. And we think Richmond, with all of its assets, all the things that we have going for it as a region, we think we're well positioned to come out of this downturn. It's been a hard couple of years economically, but for Richmond, as we've reset the economy, maybe, you know, the next 10 years, we think, hold a lot of potential. So,
but you're stronger together, right?
Stronger together, and that's where the collaborative comes in. And what we've taken great care in, what Wendy, as our project manager, has picked up our public input work and how she's constructing this, is we're making this by the people. right? So rather than just going right back to the collaborative with here's seven ideas, engaging these people in the community, such as yourself that came to these meetings, placing them in the work groups to say, okay, now we need the how, and having mm-hmm. them determine the how and making those recommendations, we think it has a much greater odds for success.
So that's the buy-in, is getting them to talk about the how.
Exactly. And that's what Wendy's constructed with these work groups. We had the first one that Wendy can talk about that mm-hmm. we're off to a great start. Yeah. I think the first one was really exciting.
And which one was this?
James River.
James River, okay.
Yeah, leveraging the James River, had their first group meeting.
So you're using child psychology to try and get our very adult governments to work together by getting them to buy into the idea of, well, once we've invested our time in talking about these things and coming up with the solutions, it doesn't look very good if we don't do these things.
That's one way to put it. that's the Chris Dovey way to put it. I like to say that, you know, we're talking about half of the government people on the coordinating council are elected. And we all know that elected, and even those that aren't elected, say we got to take care of our jurisdiction, the people in our jurisdiction. But what we heard, what people said, and we didn't talk about the map, the region that we're actually talking about. So I'd like to go back to that after I make this point. But
it's pretty big.
Yeah, it is big. But what we heard across the board was they want to see, we, the community, wants to see more regional collaboration. So if the government officials are, it's not necessarily reverse psychology, but it is, if you really do want to serve the people in your jurisdiction, listen to them. This is what they're telling you. And yes, you know, somebody might stand up and complain about the new road going somewhere, but, you know, but
what's interesting, it's a different way of doing this, though. I mean, you're not looking for them to sign a contract with America kind of thing where they're saying, we're going to do this or we'll just quit our jobs or something. We're saying, buy into this process, become a part of the process,
right.
And it becomes more difficult to ignore your solution.
And I think the other point is some of this is collaboration among governments, but some of it's collaboration among nonprofit sectors.
And business. Corporate.
Some includes business. So there can be a lot of partners in this effort, and we think there will be.
Nonprofit was not originally part of the leadership of this. That's now being brought in, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. Through the work groups right now, we have most of the chairs are from nonprofits or the non-business, non-governmental entities. Yeah.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Was there a method to that?
No, but when you think about some of these issues, who owns them other than government? You know, you're not going to find many businesses that own the social stability area, right? They mm-hmm. are concerned about it for their employees or their customers or what have you. And then maybe they give philanthropically in the region towards that, but they're not, it's not their necessarily, they aren't the subject matter experts. But those people may be on the groups too. We do have a lot of philanthropists on the groups, because one of the things that I think, you know, our hope is that if we get those philanthropic dollars swimming in the same direction as the government, as the business, as the nonprofits, and we're all looking at this regional agenda and kind of saying, yeah, these are our priorities, it's, you know, it becomes easier for them to figure out what to fund.
But was there a reason why they were not part of the initial beginnings of this process? Or
As we started this, we felt that it was important first couple of steps to get government and business, as Wendy said, you know, moving in the same direction in a cohesive manner. And, you know, we thought it was important to take the time to build that part of the process. How we've engaged a nonprofit through this is we made it a priority to speak to most of the nonprofit groups, which gave great input into this process.
And a lot of your meetings were, again, Daily Planet, et cetera,
exactly
through those things. And when do you come from the nonprofit community, right?
Correct. My entire professional life has been
nonprofit.
We're not going to be successful at this without the engagement of the nonprofit. And I think, as Wendy noted, many of them are leading the work groups, and you know, we just view them as critical. And the other challenge was, if you think of the nonprofit community, if we were to try to identify one, two, or three to include on an organizing council, who do you include? And we were concerned about excluding people mm-hmm. as well. So we think this has worked as a good process. We can invite everybody to the table now in these work groups and get their input.
Now, what are the next steps? And I guess, what is how does this continue to happen? Again, it's sort of a verb as much as it is a noun.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
How do we continue in this action? Is it funded in some way? Is it does it have an ending point? How do we gauge success?
Well, I think that it's partially funded. I'm not a volunteer. so it is funded for maybe another year or so to continue this type of work. And I think that, you know, it's important to note that a project like this, maybe all of us sitting around the table say this is really important, but when the rubber hits the road, if it works, then people will fund it. Then people will say this is important for our community to continue to do this, to continue to have these groups meet. You know, maybe it's, you know, collaboration for the sake of collaboration, again, is going to be something that I say all the time, because it's what we heard the community say is it's not well done here, is that that's true collaboration where you get everybody going in the same direction, not just sitting around the table looking at each other.
And I think that's also something that's different for this community. Most government-led initiatives, you do a report, you hold a press conference, you publish it, and it's done.
And it goes on that shelf down at City Hall.
What's different about this is a commitment to ongoing accountability and sustaining this effort. The Richmond Regional Planning District Commission, our elected officials have committed to this as a regional priority.
And the chamber.
And the chamber. So,
chamber.
You know, so from the government standpoint,
for Kim there.
Right. Our staff time is here to support Wendy. The chamber, through their foundation, is funding Wendy. So they've really been at the forefront of this as well. And, you know, what we talked about is that this organizing team is not going away. You know, we're going to stay. We're going to be accountable. Mm-hmm. Wendy talks about measuring indicators
right.
of success.
And there's a group forming around Richmond that's talking about we need to get some community indicators. And sometimes they're very minute detailed. There are other regions that are doing this. And we're part of that group as well. So that's another way that I think that this work is going to continue to live on, because it's going to feed into what are we measuring for our community to say that we're moving
so
in a positive
direction.
So hopefully
we make this verb something that we continue to take
right.
action on.
Right.
And real quick, you had mentioned who's part of it. It's Goochland, Powhatan, Chesterfield, Charles City, New Kent, Hanover, Ashland, Richmond, of course, at the center, and then you can't leave out Henrico.
Henrico, right. Right. So it's nine municipalities that make up that. When we talk region, that's what we're talking about. And when we talk about work groups, we're trying to get representation from each of those municipalities.
So that really is huge.
Right. Mm-hmm. And let me mm-hmm. follow up on that a second. So you're
and
talking
diverse.
About 1 million people, a land area that's larger than the state of Delaware, and a land area that's larger than the state of Rhode Island, to put that in a little perspective.
Wow. So we're like a little mini state.
it's a large region, but that really contributes to our strength. It's that diversity of living environments, of, mm-hmm. you know, the rural, the suburban, the urban interface that we have here. We really have everything one could look for in that geographic region.
All right. And then I guess just to summarize, one answer, one word answers, is it perception that we don't collaborate already?
Yes and no. Answered as a true government person.
You're answering right? for both you and Kim, right?
Well,
you get two answers.
What I'll say to that is let me say this. Have we collaborated successfully on a number of projects? I could sit here and run through a bunch of from our international airport
sure.
to our downtown convention center,
but
to regional money placed in the city, to the Port of Richmond,
but
to the Virginia Capitol Trail. So there have been, and I could go on and rattle off all those successes, but is there work to do? Absolutely.
All right. And again, Bob Crum, Executive Director of the Richmond Regional Planning District Commission, and Wendy Bertner-Owens, Project Manager with the Capital Region Collaborative, a verb and a noun.
And a noun.
and we're here talking about the first phase of the end of the beginning of the regional collaborative.
If you say so.
The Capital Region Collaborative. You've put out sort of an interim report. And this is available online right now?
Yes.
And where would I go to find that?
CapitalRegionCollaborative.com.
And it's also in a lovely book form. And
it is in a lovely book
are
form.
Are these out already?
They are.
Bookstores near you?
Right, yes.
Where would I go to get
$2.99.
one?
$2.99. No. you can go to the website and download the PDF, or you can contact me and I can if there's a group of people that, or even just one person, I guess, that wants them, I can send them out as well.
Great. Thank you, guys.
And could maybe we take a second, if Wendy could describe, if there's listeners that want to be engaged in this effort, maybe Wendy could talk about how you could get on a work group.
Sure. You just, I mean, that's simple. Yeah. You let me know.
Quickly.
Go to the website. My email's all over the website, and with the hyphenated last name, I'm not going to spell it out. So go to the website, find my email, let me know which work group you want to be on.
It is readily available out there if you go to their website. And yep. Thank you guys very much for coming today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
All right.
Broadcast of Open Source RVA on WRIR is sponsored in part by Haberdasher Corporate Apparel, a locally owned, SWAM-certified, woman-owned business, providing uniforms, logo apparel, t-shirts, and promotional products to businesses, schools, and nonprofits in Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic region. More about Haberdasher can be found on Facebook and the web at haberdashercorporateapparel.com or by calling 804-878-7630. Thank you, Haberdasher.
The old saying goes that when the good Lord closes a door, he opens a window. But what if your living space has no windows? At first, it doesn't seem like such a big deal, especially if you're a student living on the cheap. But actually it is, if you believe scientists. Natural light is critical to our physiology, and sunlight is responsible not only for helping to set our internal body clocks, but also beneficial to our mental well-being. So why is there a current trend to build apartment buildings in Richmond with units that have no windows? It's a question worth asking, considering our city's usual penchant for nitpicky building codes and regulations. And architect David Johannes, a member of the city's planning commission, and Style Weekly news editor Scott Bass have been among those pondering this question. Bass recently wrote a disturbing article for Style that shed some light on the issue. And Johannes was one of the main voices in that article worrying about the long-term effects of windowless apartments. They joined me today on Open Source RVA. Thanks for being here, guys.
Welcome. Thank you.
I'll start with you, David. You're on the city's planning commission, which recommended that this was an okay thing to do. But the issue came up before you came aboard, correct?
It did, yes. Resolution was passed, I believe, maybe around last April.
And you've been asking some fellow architects around the country about windowless living spaces?
Yes, we have a internet connectivity program in the AIA where we join knowledge communities. And in these knowledge communities, we can ask questions of other architects, and we see what kind of responses we get. So I posed the question a couple of times over and began to collect at least some opinions from other architects and data from other cities to see what was going on in other places.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the thoughts that came out?
Well, originally, people couldn't quite grasp the concept of the question that I was asking about windowless apartments. They were thinking about windowless bedrooms, windowless rooms, but the concept of the windowless apartment didn't quite settle in. So my first round of questions didn't go very far. Second round, I was a little more explicit, and I asked two questions. The first question I asked was, do other architects agree that a windowless apartment is a substandard housing? Mm-hmm. And the second question I asked is, are windowless apartments being developed in other regions of the country, and do you see this happening in other places?
Mm-hmm.
And the general responses I got were overwhelmingly everybody agreed that windowless apartments are substandard housing. And the second part of the question was answered also, where apparently this is not being developed elsewhere in the country. Mm. None of the other architects had mentioned anything until recently. One person had mentioned one project that he was aware of. So that begins to give us the image that we are the one place in the country that's doing this, and this is a vernacular style of architecture that we have here currently.
Hmm. Scott, your article in Style was really eye-opening. I'm not sure people really think about the importance of having windows that allow natural light. You talked to both proponents and critics of this trend. What did they say?
Well, the proponents are, you know, the developers who are developing the windowless, you know, apartment complexes. You know, I think that it's important to differentiate. There aren't, I don't know how many of the units actually have no natural light. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one thing not to have a window. Some of them do have like skylights and little portholes, and they have wind. They have some. They get somehow manage to get light into the unit, just not an external window to the outside. There are those, and the big one that we looked at had that had a majority of its units without windows had some of those accommodations. You know, they try to create hallways that had skylights over them, and they would direct light indirectly into the units. And there were some, but there are some where there's not. I mean, literally not a skylight or a shred of natural light coming into the apartment. And I guess so there are two different things that were going on. The projects that have a handful of units that have no windows and no light at all, those were generally tend to be, you know, well, we have a little bit of space left over. We got to do something with it. You know, it's not a majority of the units. And those are inarguably bad. For people. And, you know, you can look at the research that's out there. Not getting any natural light into a living space can be detrimental.
What are the effects? Well, you also got into the effects. What are the effects of that, not having natural light?
Well, they don't really know all the different effects yet, because just in doing some of the initial research, it's only in the last few years have they discovered, you know, this different set of photoreceptors in your eyeball that, that sort of set your internal body clock. And there have been studies out there that look at workers who work in an office or the graveyard shift or in environments where there's no natural light or no windows, and the negative health effects that it can have. You know, myriad. Supposedly it's linked to cancer and higher stress levels and all that kind of stuff. And that's just generally bad for you. But the overriding issue is you don't really, without natural light, your internal body clock gets knocked completely out of rhythm. And that's just very, very bad for you on a lot of different levels. And they don't really know to the extent of how bad it could be to be in an environment and what the very specific medical effects of that are yet.
Well, in the piece, you told the story of a VCU student, Matt McCabe, who rented a windowless apartment at Coliseum Lofts.
Right.
What happened to him over the course of several months living in those conditions?
Well, you know, and one of the professors that I spoke with said, you know, what happens is not getting exposure to natural light, you don't realize what it's doing to you. And what happens when people get seasonal affective disorder, which is you get depressed in the wintertime when there's less light and you see more. People commit suicide during certain parts of the year, is that they don't realize it's going on. And I think he kind of, you know, there's no way to know for sure, but in the year that he was in that windowless apartment, he talked about kind of being closed off. You know, he was spent a lot of time being very reflective, and he didn't know the people in this building, you know, he didn't really talk to them a lot, and he felt a little isolated. And there are other issues, like, you know, he'd wake up in the middle of the night and not know if it was morning, day, and he would have his car packed up and ready to go back home to, you know.
He wanted to get the heck out.
Right.
Yeah.
And every Friday when classes let out. And then, of course, when he moved into his new unit this year, it had, I want to say, five or six windows or more. And immediately it's, oh, the people in the building are nicer. And, you know, I'm really enjoying the semester. And I'm not even sure that he really knows, you know, it's not something that you're really, subconsciously it affects you and you don't even realize it.
David, is this new? Is this something that's just started, or has this been going on for several years?
In terms of developing windowless
units,
Wow, I think it's been going on for at least 10 years. It's, you know, I really haven't kept track of it. It's just something that I've just started thinking about. And it's kind of snowballing and seems to just be part of the way the renovation cycle has occurred in our city.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever find out if skylights actually do mitigate the problem?
I visited one that was under development, and there was natural light in the units that mm-hmm. I saw, but you know, there weren't but so many that were opened to
right.
You know, they were completed yet, and I'm sure that they showed me one of the nicer ones that had lots of light. So, yeah, I did. I was able to visit one, a few of them, and it did appear that there was a decent amount of light coming in. But there's also the issue of not being able to see outdoors. And,
right.
you know, getting the light into the apartment is one thing, but being able to look out the window mm-hmm. and sort of connect with the outside world is also psychologically important. And you don't get that with skylights.
Yeah, and one of the developers that you quoted said that skylights are actually better than windows as far as allowing natural light in. Is there any evidence to support that?
Well, it's certainly, I think they have a valid point because mm-hmm. the skylights are up in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have windows on one side of the room and another, you only get light during certain parts of the day. So
right.
there is something to be said for having skylights. Good one. I mean, you know, the question is how big is the skylight? You know,
mm-hmm.
the ones that I saw, they were fairly big, but, you know, like I said, they showed me the ones that they probably wanted me to see.
What are some of the most egregious local examples of this, as far as apartment complexes that have no unit or have few units with windows?
Egregious, you know, the one that passed earlier this year is the biggest in terms of volume, the number of units.
Mm-hmm.
Which was? It was almost 100 or thereabouts of the 150 or so. I have to go back and look at the numbers, but it was more than 3/4 of the units did not have windows. And that was one of the reasons why this came to everyone's attention was because, mm-hmm. you know, it's one thing to have a couple units squirreled away in the basement that don't have windows. And it's
right.
another thing to come to the Planning Commission with a majority of the units without windows. So that, I mean, in terms of, that's the big one we know about.
Mm-hmm.
I would not say that I have done an exhaustive research to figure out, you know, where the worst ones are.
Right, right. Well, as you reported in the article, the city's Office of Planning and Community Development recently voted on 6 apartment projects with windowless units, and they required special use permits. In those 6 projects, 232 apartments didn't include external windows. Is that a high number?
That's not really that huge a number. It sounds like a lot of units, mm-hmm. and but when you think about all the units coming into the city and how many thousands of people are moving into the city for apartment living, that's not a huge number, but it is substantial, and it does show a proliferation. Not that hard a word, of units being developed without windows. And I think the concern is that as we see more and more of this type of housing being developed, these are the first types of units that are going to fall by the wayside when the economy changes or when
mm-hmm.
we reach that point where the apartments, where the market is saturated. And that's a real concern. I would think that, you know, probably from this point on, I think the Planning Commission will be concerned about that, because when you're granting special exceptions, the goal is that they're successful special exceptions and
mm-hmm.
not ones that'll fail 10 years down the road or 15 years down
right.
the road. The initial rentals aren't probably that difficult because they're new and they're fresh and they're nicely painted and they have nice finishes. But 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, they're going to be a different story. And we could be promoting future, I wouldn't go so far as to say slum dwellings, but, you know, substandard mm-hmm. housing developments that won't succeed.
Well, talk about how state and federal tax credits and how the conversion of industrial buildings into apartments has played a factor. Scott?
Oh, well, yes. The state and federal tax credits. If you talk to developers, architects, pretty much everyone who's in this business, they'll tell you that without the availability of historic state and federal tax credits, these projects wouldn't be done, period,
mm-hmm.
or wouldn't be
possible. So the public
is
basically supporting this.
It's essentially a subsidy. And the way tax credits work is you get, and the whole point is to sort of create a program and then an incentive to redevelop historic buildings that have otherwise outlived their usefulness. For, you know, if you look at Scott's Addition or Manchester, you know, the reason why they're going to these areas is because they have large industrial buildings that are no longer of use for whatever industry that used to be there, and they're historic. So the way the credits work is you get 20% from the feds and 25% of the value of the construction project. You get tax credits toward this. So if you spend, if you spend $1 million, you'll get, what does that come to? $450,000 in tax credits. Well, what happens is you link up with a large corporation or a group that's interested. I mean, most people don't pay that much in taxes to begin with. So, but, Dominion or Markel or one of these larger corporations does. So they'll get together and they'll say, okay, well, we'll create an entity that will use those tax credits. And they essentially sell the tax credits. You know, right. The feds in the state hate that term because, there are other tax implications for doing that. They don't pay taxes on the purchase of the credit.
They also sometimes deny that it's actually public money.
Well, of course. But in essence, what happens is that those groups, the corporations get together, they agree to, in essence, buy the tax credits, and that becomes a big part of your equity that goes into to the borrower, and you're able to go into the game with, a good chunk of your money or the project paid for, right? I mean, right. It's a pretty hefty incentive. And most people will tell you that, if that weren't available, the numbers just wouldn't work. They'd be out in the suburbs building brand new houses. It's much cheaper. It's much harder to go into an older building and convert it. So the incentive is key. We would not see the development of this many apartment complexes in Richmond if that weren't available.
Well, as you recounted in the Style Weekly article, at the same time we're building all of these windowless apartments, the trend in prison construction is to install windows to help with the mental well-being of prisoners. So it's good for prisoners and not for ordinary people?
Well, I don't know that we can say that it's a trend per se. I don't know that it's going on in other parts of the country. I do know that the Richmond City Jail, I was in one of the meetings when they were unveiling their prison design. It's a beautiful building, by the way. And one of the things they highlighted was the fact that this prison would have windows in every cell, and they found that that was important in terms of controlling behavior. They understand that with prisoners having some access to natural light helps in their behavior issues, right?
So you
control them a little easier. Now, whether or not, obviously, people aren't locked in their apartments per se.
Right.
So, it's maybe a little unfair to go that far, but the point is clearly if we can see the value in windows in our prisons, then perhaps we could see the value in our apartment complexes that we approve.
Right. Well, talk about something else. Talk about safety concerns, the fact there's no availability of windows.
I don't think we're really looking at safety concerns. I think life safety is fairly well protected by the code. The code allows this. There's legal egress. There's sprinkler systems in these multifamily buildings. So in terms of actual life safety, I don't think it's a concern. I think the concerns are more focused on the health and welfare of the people in the buildings.
Ventilation wouldn't be a...
If the power goes out for 5 days, ventilation's a little tough. You don't have a window. I guess you could climb up and try and break open your skylight and get some air in there. But also, some of the complaints I've heard from people who've lived in these is the smells and the odors of other apartments seem to linger a little longer because the transfer of air doesn't seem to work as successfully. But it just going back to the whole idea of people want to be connected. We need connectivity. We need to see the outside world. And certainly in design and architecture and in an architecture school, we're trained to make that connection. We want to see the weather. We want to see the rain. We want to see the snow. And if you're cut off from that, that's a little difficult. I mean, you can open up your phone and take a look and see what it looks like out there. But you can't see the downpour. You can't see how hard it's coming down. You know, mm-hmm. those are really things that, you know, we all, if you think about the way we behave, we all kind of run to a window to look to see what's going on out
right,
there.
Right.
So when you take that away, you just begin to disconnect people. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, you know, if we all think about it that way, there's a sense of logic in terms of what it's like to not live with that connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, are the Planning Commission, are they just being unusually lax in this case by allowing more of these windowless apartments to be built? You notice I didn't ask David that.
You can ask me that.
You know, that's, to be honest, I don't know that I'm in the best position to say that. You know, mm-hmm. I know that there was at least one member on the Planning Commission who
right,
was
it was 7-1, right?
Right. Doug Cole did not approve of it, and they did pass some kind of a resolution not long after they approved it, saying that they were discouraging windowless units going forward. So, you know, I, to be honest, I just don't think it's ever really been an issue, because typically there just haven't been that. And this one particular project had so many of the units that did not have windows that mm-hmm. it kind of brought all of this out. But I don't know if it's a matter of them being lax or not really knowing how to deal with it, or having ever had to deal with it before, and whether or not, you know, because, I mean, I didn't know. I mean, and yeah. I think people who go into apartments, you know, if you're a VCU student and you're coming on a campus, you may not even think about mm-hmm. whether or not a windowless unit was really going to be a good thing for you a year from now, or midway through the semester, just because you've probably never lived in a unit that didn't have some kind of window.
Right. I've never even thought about it, really. But it is a factor. It is something that your body kind of expects, or your mind kind of expects.
Right. But it's even the research looking at natural light is still it's still relatively new. They don't know all the different things that the negative things that can happen to you without it.
I think what happened in Richmond is this started as, you know, a few apartments were done this way, maybe one project was done this way, and, you know, nobody really paid much attention to it, and then a few more were done. But now that we sit back and we start looking at them, we see the proliferation of this. We see that, finally got that word out, we see that maybe these aren't a good idea. Mm-hmm. And so I think by communicating with the rest of the country, talking to other people, we begin to realize that this is not a good idea, and we should really take control over it.
And we should underline that this isn't something that's going on around the
nation.
It
is not. And a couple of the responses, one was from a planner in Austin, Texas, and they're pretty open community there. And the guy said, boy, if we're going to start seeing that around here, we're going to have to change some local laws, because we can't have that. Same thing sort of happened in San Francisco, another comment from San Francisco. Comment from New York City is, we just don't allow that here. We've had laws that we've been working on for over a century to tackle this problem, and we continue to have more laws. We've got to have a lot of ventilation and windows in our apartments. So another city, I think Philadelphia, has backup plans in their zoning to make sure that they have apartments with windows. So we're just sort of learning something. You know, we extended ourselves as a community. We're doing a huge amount of renovation work. And in the process, we just happen to do something that, you know, we can reflect upon now mm-hmm. and think about correcting.
Right, right. So what recourse do citizens have in order to stop this? I call it a trend.
I don't know about what that recourse they have to stop this as a trend, but I think one of the things that we can look at is, and one thing that I think would be great is to start a dialogue with the National Park Service. A lot of these projects, or maybe all of these projects, are historic rehabilitation tax credit projects. Mm-hmm. And if all of them are historic tax credit projects, then the question arises is there something that we can do through the National Park Service, which we basically
Well, the National Park Service, what happens is architects will submit, or the developer will submit their plan to the state. They'll look at it, and they'll say this does or doesn't meet the historical preservation standards, and then they send that up to the Park Service. And typically my understanding is the Park Service, for the most part, rubbers. If it passes muster with the state, it's almost guaranteed to pass muster with the feds. But the real point agency is the state. They're managing the process. And what you're saying
is... The state is the gatekeeper.
Right,
however,
the gatekeeper.
I think the National Park Service sets the interpretation of the secretary's standards, and all work is supposed to be done in accordance with the secretary's standards. And the goal is preservation on their side, or they're leaning more and more towards more preservation versus just rehabilitation. So when we think about their interpretation is focused on the building and how the spaces are being preserved and how circulation elements are being preserved in the building. But their focus hasn't been on what is the design of what happens on the interior. So I put more leaning towards the feds as being the setting the standards for interpretation, and then the state is more the gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. Frequently, the state will argue a cause to the feds for a client or for an applicant. So that's how I think it works. I could have it be muddled because I'm not really a tax credit expert.
Right.
But we do
apparently
tax
only a handful of people are.
But I would add, and I may be going out on a limb here, but the goal, if I understand it correctly, is to see these buildings become useful again and back come online. They're not empty, preserve them. And we're basically subsidizing developers to allow for the preservation of these buildings. Well, if we're building windowless units, or if we see a proliferation of this in a few years from now when the market for apartments starts to dip, they go empty, or that you can't lease out the buildings, then what purpose have you served? And did you subsidize a project that essentially didn't work? So, I think tax dollars in the end are being diverted to help finance the preservation of these buildings. And if they're not preserved beyond a certain point, it's not working.
Yeah, what's the point?
Right.
One sort of backup statement there. I do also want to point out the program is an extraordinary program.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that the program is probably the single most important item or issue that is responsible for the rejuvenation of Richmond and the city of Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
Just that so much money was channeled into this region for rehabilitation of historic properties.
Mm. Well, we've been talking to David Johannes, a member of Richmond's Planning Commission, and Style Weekly News editor Scott Bass. We've been talking about the current trend of building windowless apartments in Richmond. Thanks for coming, guys.
Thank you.
I'm Don Harrison, and you're listening to Open Source RVA. And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, October 5th, 2012. I'm Don Ray of Hope Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Sunshine Daydream Dovey and Amy Temperature Change Daniel. Our producer is Jay, Is It Day or Night Westerman, and our associate producer is Gabby Season Cycle Shatzi. Our board op in absentia is Rachel Let There Be More Light Solomon. Pull back the curtains and you'll see that this and past episodes of Open Source RVA can be listened to anytime you want. You and your body clock can log on to the Open Source RVA Facebook page for links to our podcasts and get information on the news featured each week on WRIR's Audio News Digest. Got a news tip you want us to illuminate? Email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week on the breath of fresh air that is Open Source RVA. The mighty ship descends.